This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Means to explain the juxtaposition of the parasha that deals with Sotah, with the sacred and sacred woman, and the parasha of the Nogid, where a man undertakes voluntarily to to keep away from wine and grape products and not to cut his hair for a period of 30 days. The Gemara said, in order to explain these juxtapositions, Ramon Nisma called Parashat Nozir the Parashat Sotah. Why is the Parashat of Nozir placed next to the Parashat of Sotah? Leymar Lecho, say to you, you should call Haraya Sotah the Kifuna. Anybody who saw a Sotah in her disgrace, an unfaithful woman in her state of disgrace, Nozir Atmeen in Hayayi should keep himself away from wine. Because wine brings to improper behavior, which is the case. I want to take that a little bit further in understanding the meaning of that chazal. Last night we discussed some interesting rashi. Rashi asks the question further on in the Sefer. Ezra says, by Yehi Beyon Kalos Moshe Lahakim Lahakim Et HaMishkan, and was on the day that Moshe finished erecting the Mishkan. And Rashi asks, it wasn't Moshe at all who built the Mishkan. It was Yitzhak and Aviyah and all the sons of Levi. There were other people who did it. It wasn't Moshe. Rashi answers that he should mosa nafshoi olov liyavis tavnis kodolov and kodolov kumoshe herol bahar avirus eis yam loko and it's all tavnita. So Moshe was made to nefesh. Moshe expressed extreme sacrifice for the building of the Mishkan. Although he wasn't involved in the physical construction, he was very much involved in the concept of the Mishkan, and that it was he who brought the concept and the plan in detail from Sinai to the Ark. And Rashi tells us that Moshe was made to Nefesh, he was sacrificed to ensure that he was able to recall and reconstruct and make the Mishkan capacity of the Torah on the Sinai. What an easy thing to remember every detail, reconstruct, go through it, kitchen activities correctly, to make sure that the final product would meet exactly the specifications which were shown to him on Hasira. We discussed this Rashi from certain aspects last night. There's one further dimension that I want to put onto it this evening, which will help us in our general understanding. That is, we spoke a couple of weeks ago about the subject of the object, the gavra of the chet. That our whole lives revolve around relationships between gavra and chet, or between subject and object. The world around us, our environment, is the object with which we deal, and we are the subjects. And even in interpersonal relationships, there's a subject and there's an object. There's one who is leading and one who is being led, there's one who is influencing and one who is being influenced at any given moment in a relationship. And we said these relationships can switch around. One moment one will be influencing the other, and the next moment will be the other one who's influencing the first one again. But at any given moment, one person is the gatherer and one person is the head, so one is acting upon the other. And it's not always that we act upon our environment. Unfortunately, it happens only too often that our environment acts upon us. where the environment becomes the governor and we become the chetzos. But also when I said it's not a clear distinction that the material world there outside is the chetzer, that's the object, and we are the subject. Sometimes we are the subject and sometimes the material world is the subject. And today particularly the environments are very potent and the material world is very potent. One can have a little box in one's lounge that can affect crime rate. I think we mentioned it's been established beyond any doubt whatever that the displaying of violence on television affects the crime rate not over a long period of time. That we've suspected for a long time already that through the crime that is shown and the violence that is shown on television, we are raising a violent generation. That sounds much worse than that. The next day the crime rate gets. Not just that you're raising a violent generation, who's the governor, who's the head? If a box in the lounge can make a parent batter a child, or a husband murder a wife, or to cause a dramatic increase in violent crimes the next day, who's the governor, who's the head? Who's manipulating and who's being manipulated? When you see the fellow sitting in front of that box, unable to turn it off, totally impotent, frozen, unable to get up and turn it off, although he's got lots to do, more important things to do, although he's not terribly interested in the program, there he sits, until he gets to the end, when they sing the stem or whatever they do at the end. Finally, when the last words of the stem fade out, and he still waits just to make sure there might still be an encore, and then he waits and waits, and when he finally sees the test pattern come back on the screen, then he figures it's time to turn off. Who's manipulating who? Who's the governor and who's the chefter? And so when we talk about governor and chefter, about subject and object, one has to be very careful to realize that it's not objectively the boundary. These things depend on the relationship. And every relationship has a subject and an object. Not dividing the world into subjects and objects. In a relationship, we're saying a relationship consists of a subject and an object. And as sure as we have the opportunity to learn that same concept a little bit in a halakhic context, the use of that understanding of gavra and chefta, the understanding of the difficult rabbis. In Hebrew, there is no word which really means the possessive. This is my house. Hebrew, there's really no such word. You say, Habayit Sheli. The house relates to me as this. It's not mine, the actual possessive doesn't really exist. Shayakhi, which Shayak also means, it refers to me. Ownership as such of a material article isn't a word that really conveys that meaning of possession and ownership. It's very difficult, if not impossible, conceptually for a human being to own something material in the sense of that becomes part of him. Not so when it comes to the world of concepts and ideas. One can absorb an idea to the point where that idea becomes part of me. It affects me, it changes me. That's possible. One takes that a step further. Physical activity doesn't really redefine. It's in English we talk about that, so he's a soccer player, he's a builder. But that doesn't really tell us much about the mensch. It doesn't tell us what he does, but it doesn't tell us much about the person himself. Not so when one's dealing with concepts. When one absorbs an idea, that changes the individual. A person who has learnt the Mesilas Yeshori and has absorbed and excluded and integrated is not the same person as one left. His system of values is not the same. His system of motivation is not the same. He's not the same human being. He's not the same as he was before he learned the Mesillas Yesharim. I'm talking of really learning it, of acquiring the knowledge, not just accumulating the facts, but of understanding, integrating and absorbing. Not the same person, not the messengers learned through the Yuchas of the Ramah. A person who's learned through Shas, understands, knows, opens the Gemara, was learned a particular page in the Gemara, understands it, not the same person. When one emerges from the understanding of the Sugya of Gemara, I'm not the same human being one was before. A different understanding to life. There's a new depth, there's a new sensitivity that didn't exist before. Intellectual knowledge, true intellectual knowledge, deep intellectual knowledge, affects the human being in his deepest places. Actions can be automatic, they can be mechanical, they don't necessarily affect the human being. They may affect his moods, and they may affect his interests. When one constantly does something, one develops a taste for it. That, yes, it doesn't change the human being. Same way as the absorption of knowledge, true, deep knowledge and understanding does. That's why Moshe was Moshe Nefesh, for the knowledge, not for the building. He wasn't the builder. Also, we found the next example that Rashi brings is David HaMelech. David was Moshe Nefesh, also he gave his life. So to find out the knowledge, he just wanted to understand where the Beis HaMikdash would be built and so on. How it would be built, he knew. What the Beis HaMikdash was, he knew. All he wanted was one piece of information he didn't have. It was important for the whole picture. Where? The Beis HaMikdash to get that knowledge. Knowledge is something we've fought for. Knowledge is something we've given our lives for. We've struggled for. Because that changes us. That can become mine. It's worth fighting for knowledge. Because when I've got it, it's mine. What material thing is really mine? What material thing can I acquire which cannot be taken away from me by the creditors or by the nobles? What is it? One thinks that one's secure, one isn't. It's here one day, gone the next day. Not so with understanding. One can forget. One forgets facts. One doesn't forget understanding. Once you've understood something, that's evidence. You might forget the details. You might forget what it was that taught you that. But the maturity which takes place during the process of understanding, the consequence of the additional depth which one has acquired, that cannot be lost. That's mine. So when we talk, who built the Mishkan? Whose is the Mishkan? Is it the builders? Does it belong to the builders? No. They weren't changed people after building the Mishkan to the way they were before. Building something doesn't change a person. Who was changed after the Mishkan? Moshe. The one who gave his life to absorb the details and the understanding and the principles of every aspect of the Mishkan. He's the one who was a changed person. The Mishkan is his. Shlomo HaMelech built the Beis HaMikdash, the first Beis HaMikdash. He collected the money for it. He collected the material for it. He mobilized the workforce. He supervised it. Was the Beis HaMikdash his? No, says Rashi. The A base for building. Look at your house, O building. It wasn't even built in his day. Why is it his house? He struggled to understand it, to absorb it. And in fact, to be innovative. It was his idea. The whole concept of the Beis HaMikdash was, so to say, his chiddush. He thought that the time was right. He wanted to do it. And he worked it all out in detail as to how it should be done. So the efforts of the Torah are focused far more on the Gavra than they are on the Chet. It's the person, the individual, the subject, which the Torah is primarily interested in. You know, the old philosophic questions of how do we know whether the world around us really exists, maybe it's all an illusion. if you're in the midst of a nightmare, it all looks pretty serious. And if you were asked in the midst of your nightmare by an imaginary psychiatrist whether you really believe what you're seeing, you would say, yes, it's real. He would say, don't you think it's a dream? You would say, no, until you woke up. And our answer to that philosophic inquiry is, it doesn't make too much of a difference. Whether the world is real or it's an illusion, it doesn't make any difference. What is important is, I am real, and the Ribono Shel Olam is real. That I know for sure. And the world around me is given as objects with which to build myself through my relationship to those objects, whether they're real or imaginary objects, doesn't make any difference. The relationships I construct are real. That's real. And that's what's important, to use myself, to use my subject, to change the world around me, to raise the world around me, to enter into a relationship with the world around me, which is real and meaningful and deep. But for that, I've got to put something into the world around me. Put something into the world around me, I need to have something in myself. I can't merely absorb from the world around me. Then the world becomes the gavro and I become the chetzer. If I'm always receiving, if I'm always absorbing, then the world is the gavro and I'm the chetzer. And then that philosophic problem becomes very serious, because if the world is an illusion, then I'm being manipulated by an illusion. That would be a terrible thing, and many people are manipulated by illusion. The other way around, the Torah is true, and I absorb the Torah and am able to put it out again in the way I relate to the world around me, then it's real, then it's true. And so we're concerned in the educational process of building the Gavra. Now let's go back to the Nozir and the Sotah. When I can quote in a shir or even base a shir on something which one of my talmidim was mechadish. There's a Rashi on the beginning of the parasha of Sotah. It says ish, any man, ki tiste ishta, a strange word, tiste ishta, which simply translated means a woman whose woman is suspected of having deviated, gone off the path a little bit. But the word tiste reminds us very much there's the same root as the word shoite, which means crazy person. And if that's what it means, then we would translate it any man whose wife went mad. Shana Rabbi Seyna Rashi brings a chazal. Ein hamenafin noyafin achitikanes kohen ruachshus. Manafim, adulterers, do not commit adultery until they are struck, or until a spirit of madness enters into them. A mad thing to do. Talking about people, after all, the Yorish mind, not people who raise on the street. Not talking about people who raise on the street, we're talking about Yorish mind. People who strive to the Torah. What makes them do something so destructive? His family life, her family life, children, it's just such an idiotic thing to get involved. What makes a reasonable person get involved in such a thing? Says Rashi, Chazal, becomes when blood is a disease. It's an actual, it's a form of insanity. So Leonard Gordon noticed that Rashi doesn't say, as the Gemara says, Ein Odo. A person doesn't sin until he's struck by a spirit of insanity. This is a very strange thing. An adulterer doesn't commit adultery until he's struck by a spirit of insanity. Mr. Gordon asked that he's not an adulterer yet. I'm saying an adulterer doesn't commit adultery until he's... What's the order of things? First, the spirit of insanity strikes him, then he commits adultery, then he's called an adulterer. Why does Rashi call him an adulterer before the spirit of insanity is even struck him? Mr. Gordon says that's clearly what the Rashi means. But no, the spirit only strikes adulterers. It doesn't strike innocent people. You have to be an adulterer before it strikes. There's a chidush here. You can be an adulterer before you've done anything. That's the understanding. And but the Pope got into a lot of hot water recently, like a couple of years ago, when he talked about mental adultery. Remember that? And they mocked him and laughed at him, and he kept quiet about it after that. He eventually made no further mention of it. Remember, he doesn't have a Torah Shabbat pair to draw. What he said was true. But when they challenged him, he said, it sounds idiotic. He can't say it's a Mefurash Rashi. He doesn't have such things. But that's what it is. That a person becomes a mental adulterer. Wouldn't do it. Has to show him. Would never do such a thing. These are his imaginations and his thoughts and. It's absolutely theoretical, that's for sure. Then comes the rushes. Then one's affected afterwards by an insane urge, which has no rational explanation, and which is totally uncontrollable. And then comes the avera. Concept which you see this of is Bachadish to explain the difference between the Rishonim of days gone by and the present day Rishonim, the Rishonim of his day, because this is them. The olden days they were finally wicked people. They were finally Rishonim. This is the Rishonim of those days, today would be called Tzadik. We don't have such Rishonim. When you read us Hadoris, you see the decline of the generations hasn't only affected the great people, it's affected the wicked people too. And Russia today is not of the same stature as the Russia was in days gone by. We can lay various examples for the Gemara, wonderful showing. In the midst of doing the Averis, suddenly start doing tshuva. And while they're doing Averis, they pray to the Ribbono Shel Olam to help them stop. And they, all sorts of funny showing. People who kill themselves, and the other they try to endure. The terrible things all his life before he became great, and at the end decides to do tshuva and kills himself in the process, not with suicide, but he put such effort into his tshuva that he dies from it in order to come right. Even we find such a showing today. What's happened? What is the difference? How do you explain the psychology of a Rosho who is so aware of God and godliness and the Torah and what's right and what's wrong, and regret so deeply every time he does an Avera, and yet he does it over and over again? Maybe he finds it for sure. It's a story he brings to Gemara and Sir. A fellow called Nosson Tzitzioso. Also, he was a pimp. And he wasn't only his business, but his pleasure too. And Rabbi Akiva once saw him, and so I hate him, what he said. Started inquiring, who is this man? They said, he said, but look at the halo, and he said, the light coming out. What kind of a pimp is this? They make inquiries and they found out the story that he was particularly in love with a particular woman, and he went after her and persuaded her, and she would never let him come near him, and eventually she got into a situation where she needed him for something or other, and he had privacy with her, and this was his opportunity. And she gave him a position. So, look, fine. If you want to go ahead with it, that's fine, but let me give you a drosha first, we'll learn some musa first. Afterwards, it's fine. I really imagine such a person. Yeah, he's prepared to listen to the musa. Listens to the musa. And by the time he's finished with this, as I'll say, he was pinching himself with his nails so as to bring him back to his senses and praying to the Ribbono Shel Olam to save him. He was moistened nefesh at that moment in the midst of the height of his Yetzer Hara. He was able to reverse it. It's actually not a good time. And after that, the halo appeared. Such a showing. Prepared to listen to a Musa Shmuz and prepared to abide by a Musa Shmuz, not before, not afterwards, but during. Says the Tzim Chazisal, I'm only too happy if after the Avera they're sitting in Shul on Yom Kippur and I give them a moving drosha. And a tear rolls down their faces. I say, what tzaddikim? But this is at the time of the Avera. What chance would I have, says Rav Tzim Chazisal, if I went to somebody while he was in the midst of it? Now there he stopped. Musa, let me give you a Musa shmuz. Come to the base of Medrash, I'll teach you some Musa before you go on. What chance would I have? We don't have such a shuri in it. He said, this tries to define what kind of a shuri were they? With such God-fearing a shuri. Here's what they were. That's how he defines them. And God-fearing a shuri. Wicked people who were the Yorei Shumai. And he says, the eldest name, Bur Yerechet. Bur is an empty person. That is his own thing. Can't be a Yerechet. Ask some sympathies, so why doesn't it say a Yereshamayim? Why doesn't it say Ein Bur Yereshamayim? Say some sympathies, because it can't be a Yereshamayim. It's only a Yerechet. Sympathism defines the difference between Yereshamayim and Yerechet. Yerushalayim is God-fearing. God-fearing means I believe in the Ribbono Shel and I fear him, I hold him in awe. And I know that he rewards and punishes. And it would never enter my mind, chas v'sholem, to do anything wrong. Do an aveira, chas v'sholem. That's God-fearing. I fear God. Yiras chet is a different thing. Yiras chet is I fear the sin. Not just because God said. If I fear it because God said no, that's still God fearing. That's Yerushalayim. It's the reason. Why won't you do an Aveira? What do you mean, why not? God said no. God punishes if you do Aveira. That's God fearing. That's not yet Yirat Chet. That's not yet fear of sin. Fear of sin is a different thing. Fear of sin is, if you can imagine, being shown a nuclear reactor. And they tell you, if you go into that room over there, that's where all the radioactivity is. Checked it outside. If you go inside, it's full of this radioactivity. And they said, why don't you go inside, have a look for yourself? No, I thank you. It's quite all right. And they said, well, are you a Rosha? What are you afraid of? Are you a Rosha? Are you afraid God will kill you? I said, well, I'm not afraid of God. I'm afraid of radioactivity. That's why I'm not going. I realize it's quite independent of the Ribbono Shel Olam, so to say. This is a dangerous thing. One doesn't go there. And no matter what kind of a tzaddik you are, if you go there, you die. It's a foolish thing to do. So understand that quite apart from the fact that God said no, it is inherently dangerous and damaging. And one doesn't come out alive from it. That's Yerushalayim. Why don't you sin? Not because God said no. That's one reason. That's being God-fearing. But there's a second parallel reason. I don't do the hate because I'm terrified of the consequences, not the punishment. I'm terrified of what it will do to me. I'm terrified of the effect it will have on my soul, on my being, on my personality, on my character. I don't want to be contaminated with it. That's all, irrespective of the fact that God said no. And we don't have to get into the philosophic question of whether it's inherently bad because God said no, or whether it's God said no because it's inherently bad. That's not the subject of the shiur, but the fact is that a hate, a sin, is not only bad because the Ribbono Shel Olam said no, it is inherently bad as well. Although disobeyed the Ribbono Shel Olam, sinned, it would happen to the whole of humanity as a result of that. The damage, the destruction, decay, degeneracy, death, all is the result of one action. He opened the door of the nuclear reactor. Says what's in Chizisel. A Yerechet doesn't just say to himself, I believe in God, and I believe he rewards and punishes, and therefore I would never think of doing anything wrong. He goes further. He says, my goodness, there's a chet over there, there's a sin over there. I'm going nowhere near. I'm taking the other route. You say, why? What are you afraid? You're going to come to do it. I just don't want to have anything to do with it. That's a different story altogether. Yerechet protects himself from the other. He understands that the sin is dynamic, powerful, and destructive in its own right. And therefore he takes measures within himself to immunize himself against it, to keep away from it, to come nowhere near it at all. way he does it is to ensure that it doesn't enter his consciousness. I'm talking here at high level, talking about Nureshe. This isn't something that we can all practice, but as we've often said, it's something we need to know about. Nureshe, he doesn't allow it into his mind, because he realizes once it's in his mind, he's already affected and infected by it. It's been absorbed. The concept, once it's absorbed, it's inside your system already. And just as that works with positive things, that works with Torah, with good concepts, and good ideas, you absorb them into your system, they become part of you. So if you absorb something negative, if you absorb a destructive idea, a negative idea, that becomes part of your system, part of your character, part of your personality. Then in the case of Neos, as Rashi says, you become a Manai from day. You're already a Manai, you're already an adulterer. Why? What did I do? Now that we've learned tonight, you don't have to do in order to absorb into yourself. You don't have to do something in order to become a certain type of person. People think it can make you change you, can affect you, can make you a certain type of person. If learning a Sugi of Gemara can change you, and if learning the Basidus Yeshorim can change you, learn something negative and destructive, how much more can that change you? We are not your face. We look at television indiscriminately. We feel won't affect us, very big people. We read the Sunday Times indiscriminately. It won't affect us, very big people. It's no such thing. That's like walking into the nuclear reactor and saying it won't affect me, I'm a big person. You know, hate to understand that this is being it's dangerous. And don't take the risk. Maybe it will affect you. It's just not important enough to us. We're not scared enough. We don't realize the damage that negative experience does to us. We don't protect our children from it, which is even more worrying. We see the kind of things that we're allowing our children to be exposed to. Too busy, or don't care, or don't understand. I don't know what it is. Find children sitting in front of the television watching things. And South African television is not what it was 5 years ago. It's not what I see television is, but it's not what it was 5 years ago. How is children being left in front of television because the mother is only too happy that they're quiet? You must understand, so you know, if that's your idea, that you want the children quiet and out of the way, try euthanasia. That works better. Then you'll never have to worry about them again. What, are you prepared to kill them to get them out of the way? Are you prepared to expose them to radioactivity to get them out of the way? Is that what you were given children for? Well, they're too happy, they're quiet, watching TV. They're wonderful. Books they read, friends they mix with, the language they hear, all this. And your estate worries about all this. The finer the person, the more worried he is about the effect. Of course, a real grown person, a real coarse individual, he doesn't worry, he has nothing to worry about. Nothing to affect him. He's insulated by many, many layers against any danger and risk of radiation. But he has nothing to worry about. Sensitive people, people who care, people who have Yirushamayim, ought also to have Yirushamayim. To understand, the problem is in the individual. Just look at that for a moment. Man comes along and he sees the soifa of a kinku. Terrible thing. What kind of man are we talking about? We're talking now about from people, raised in a religious environment. I've never seen anybody desecrate the Shabbos. Never mind the soifa of a woman who's been unfaithful. See the whole thing going on, and husband arguing with her, the story, the husband is there, the wife is there, the lover is there, my goodness, what am I seeing? One can imagine the approach being, get rid of sotos, ban the sotos, remove them from our society. We can't allow our society to be contaminated by such evil. And maybe there's even something right in such an attitude, provided it doesn't stop there. you remember the bus shelter incident in Yerushalayim. Hopelessly, callously, advertisements which were totally distasteful and against the halacha were plastered over the bus shelters in the religious areas of Jerusalem. And so the people took offense and spray painted them over, and bus shelters were burnt. Nobody knows who burnt them, whether it was the religious Jews or the irreligious Jews, that hasn't been established. Be that as it may, there was a violent reaction against the bus shelters or against the advertisements. Fine. Not unjustified. What does a man do when he sees a system? Only they exist. I'm scared of Satan's. They're radioactive. What can I do now to vaccinate myself, to immunize myself against the effects of what I've seen? You see the difference? Is the attention on the gardener or on the hand? You look there and say, look at that wicked advertisement, spray painted. One approach. Another approach is, my goodness, look what I've seen, what's going to happen to me now? What can I do to repair myself? What can I do to improve myself? A person under that circumstances has to undertake a period of nazirus, those that we can't do today, and to keep himself away from wine, which causes nazirus. Of course, this is all very distant from us. That means that should have happened, but by mistake. One walked into a room and one saw, that's one of these funny shows on television, Dallas, or one of these things. If such a thing happens, then one has to become a Muslim. That's the only chance one has of being able to come out of the experience unscathed. That's terrible. You don't think that. Ask the question, should we watch or shouldn't we watch? Have we got anything better to do or not? Not what it's going to do to us. That we don't even think of that. What it's going to do to us. Should we or shouldn't we? In terms of convenience rather than in terms of value system. And so it says a woman who's suspected of being unfaithful doesn't see such a thing. Never mind where it's glamorized as it is in these things. Mind that even if you see it by kilkulo, you see her in her disgrace, where society disapproves of it, and the Torah disapproves of it. And she's brought to the Beis HaMikdash, to the Kohanim, all you see is disapproval. Still you have to do something to save yourself from the effects of having seen that. We're willing to turn it on, even if we don't accept it in real life. We're willing to turn it on so that we can see it in action. And when we do see disappointing things, bad things, we concentrate our efforts on correction of the object rather than on the subject. One of the areas where we see this to a frightening extent is in the environmentalist movement. The environmentalist movement sounds very nice. It sounds very remodel, preserve the seals, be careful of acid rain, don't pollute the rivers, don't build nuclear reactors. All very nice. Then one hears, not rumors, but substantiated reports, a lot of the financing for the environmentalist movements before that. They then become political bodies. They then start political parties and have their representation as such in parliament. Germany, the Green Movement, becomes a political party. Now, I start scratching one's head in wonder. Environmentalists becoming a political party? What, What do they want exactly? Do they want to run the country, or do they want to improve the country? Is this a policy now? One becomes a little suspicious. And then one digs a little bit further and one finds that a lot of the funding is coming from Russia. But what is now what's going on? Russia is so concerned about our environment in the West. And they think all of a sudden that they're funding people to improve the West's environment when they're making no effort at all, virtually no effort at all, to improve their environment. So what is it? And then one realizes that the environmentalist movement is being funded by few, by people who preach atheism. What's the connection? The environmentalists see the solution of man's problems as the object. I don't know whether we can attribute to the Russians this depth of analysis, but I fear maybe yes. And as long as the West sees their problems in the object, they will neglect the subjects. The strength of the West has always been the subject. Were it not for strong values, strong family relationships, a strong religious feeling, a strong morals and ethics, the West would not have been able to beat it. He wasn't beaten under his banners. He was beaten with Mesiris Nefesh for ideals, for principles, which I believe. You needed to have the principles, and you needed to be prepared to sacrifice your life for those principles. The West could defeat the Nazis because of the strength of the government, not the strength of the heads. True, when it came in, they had big guns, but they had to have people to fight with Mesiris Nefesh. Can't make a soldier fight if he doesn't have the moral fabric to do so. I remember in Korea talking to some highly placed American officers who were very, very worried about the caliber, the moral and ethical caliber of the modern American soldier. And they said to me, our only hope is in nuclear warfare. Because for nuclear warfare, you don't need character. You press a button, and the one who does it first wins. We have to send young men out into the field. We have to in Vietnam. We have to before that in Korea, in the Second World War. If we have to send young men out into the field, not a long, extended, bitter war, no matter how evil the forces we're fighting, he said. They fear that the approach of the young men would be rather live as a communist and die as a freeman. Life before it is. Environmental city. Life. Protect the rivers, protect the environment. By restraining and restricting and hampering industry, by stopping to build nuclear centers, nuclear power stations, and therefore cutting down the research that goes into it, by fighting against Star Wars, anything which can hold back the progress which the West was making in the area of science and technology, that was the one end, and the environment was an ideal method to get the West to slow down a little bit, to hamper the West. And the second is to distract the attention of the West from morals, ethics, and education onto environmentalism, onto the object. Because environmentalism feeds the religious beliefs of an individual without any religion. That's the beauty of environmentalism. It's something to fight for. It's something to demonstrate for. It's something to sacrifice for. It's a principle. It's an ethical principle, in quotation marks. But there's no ethics involved. Ethics means self-improvement. Ethics means self-discipline. Ethics means the building of human stature. Here you have a movement which considers itself religious, in a sense. And there's no God, there's no mitzvahs, there's no midas, there's no musr. That movement has been created with the credibility of religious people. crime can all end. Fight crime. Crime is evil, it's bad. How do you fight crime? More policing. Arm the police. How do you fight crime? Surely one has to realize that something calls in the crime. Two, events overseas have shaken society both east and west. Shaken society beyond belief. Everybody, the man in the streets, texts go on and on and on. That horror of the knowledge that there are a whole lot of people that are going to die and you can't do anything to help them. It's one thing when there's a calamity, something happens, an explosion, a whole lot of people die, so the front pages of the newspaper, the next day it's forgotten. Finished. And it falls into the background of one's thinking, of human consciousness. But this doesn't. Because there are people walking around sick, ill, maimed. We know we're going to die, and people who haven't yet identified, we don't even know, children who maybe are unborn yet, who are going to be affected by something which happened a year ago, and which is no control. And AIDS. People still felt relatively comfortable, scared but relatively comfortable, and they believed that AIDS was only to be found among homosexual. But now it's gone wild. Now there's terror, and the helplessness, you can do nothing about it. And there are a whole lot of people who've got it who don't even know it. And these people are going to be dying one after the other in years to come because of the virus they've got now. And they don't know that they've got it, or even if they do, there's nothing they can do about it. And it's a feeling of utter helplessness. But in America alone, there are over 2 million people already, well over 2 million people affected. And it's going on and on, and while we're standing by watching, totally and utterly helpless. I can't imagine what that's done to shape society. And yet how much effort is going in to combat homosexuality, which after all was the source of it. Not the only place where it's found now, certainly that was the source of it, and certainly will contribute to its spread more than anything else. It's considered unconstitutional to fight homosexuality. You're not allowed to work on the gun. You can only work on the head. You can work in the laboratories, you can work in the universities, in the medical schools. You can work on the patients and try and solve it. So improve the moral and ethical caliber of the government, of the individual, despite the terror that reigns in the world because of this disease. There's not even an indication that that's the approach which might be taken. And likewise with nuclear reactors, to realize that nuclear energy is a wonderful gift that we've learned initially. But therein lies the answer to the depleting energy resources. It is that that will enable the world to achieve what it has to achieve in years to come. And yet it's terribly dangerous and has to be watched and preserved. So where does the answer lie? Educate the people who handle it. The people who handle it need to be responsible people. They need to be educated in the concept of responsibility. They need to be educated in the value of life. They need to be educated in the value not only of one's own life and the life of one's own society, but the lives of others as well. The people who handle the power, the politicians, the leaders, need to be educated. These people should go to yeshivas for years before they're allowed to come anywhere near nuclear reactors. The buttons that can press the trigger for a nuclear bomb. There's no thought even that the approach to the problem has to be educating people. If you educate people to be concerned about their environment, principles about tashkis, when you may use an environment, when you may not, gavra and chevtza, you must control the environment, not to let the environment control you. If you educate people in the principles of the Torah, universal principles of the Torah, you don't have to worry about the environment. Take care of yourself. Can one fight crime when children are raised in schools and universities being taught that there is no right and wrong? There's no right way to talk and no wrong way to talk. There's no right grammar or wrong grammar. There's no right way to dress or wrong way to dress. There's no right way to address a teacher or wrong way to address a teacher. It's just a matter of you have an exam. and you need certain facts to in order to be able to pass the exam, and I'm being paid to give you those facts. So if you want the facts, here they are, write your exam and get out of here. That's the education. Are we surprised that later on it's a crime? It used to be a time when the child used to be taught. The teacher comes in, you stand up. Why? Because it's right. The teacher goes up, stand up. Why? Because it's right. That's not the way to punctuate. But to punctuate in a different way. Why? Because that's the way we punctuate. That's not correct style. That's not correct grammar. Why? Do you understand what I'm saying? Yes, I do understand what you're saying, but it's still not correct. There used to be a time when a child was hammered over and over again during his school day. This is right, and this is wrong, and this is the right way to do it, and this is the wrong way to do it. Now do it again and get it right. And they kept on hearing this word, right and wrong, correct and incorrect. Child doesn't get it anymore. This is the facts. You're able to repeat the facts, or you're not able to repeat the facts. The fact that schools are producing illiterate people, people who can't read, people who can't write. I mean, who can't read and understand what they're reading, or write in a way that somebody else can understand what they're writing, it means they haven't been taught the rights and wrongs of reading and writing. Because moral and ethics has been decided is not the role of a school teacher to teach. He's got to give information. And then we worry about fighting crime. Luckily in England, there's the dawning, at least in this area, that's the approach that needs to be taken. The approach to crime is in the schools, not in the streets, that's too late. It has to be tackled at the child level, it has to be tackled in the school. Nozir comes along, man comes along, he sees a disgusting scene, woman has been unfaithful, a grieved husband, a defiant lover. What does he do? Close his eyes, walk away, talk against them, ban them, banish them. All that might be necessary, but that's not where it stops. He realizes, I've already come too close to our marriage. That's all. It's in me now. The problem is in me. That's where I'm going to start. The Gavra needs to be fortified. The Gavra, the subject, needs to be strengthened. That's where the disease has to be combated. Not outside there, right in here. That's the educational process. The Torah prays us with another. And that really is the entire educational process to which we need to be dedicated. Ourselves, our children, our mother, to realize that as long as we're going to look at the solution to human problems in the object, we are not going to solve human problems. We simply need to define, is this a technological problem, or is this a human problem? If it's a technological problem, then it is right for us to try and solve it in technology and in the object. But if we decide it's a human problem, there's only one place we can seek the solutions, and that's in the human being. If we decide that AIDS is a human problem, then the answer is in education, not in medicine. It doesn't mean that the doctors don't have to continue to try and find cures. They need to save people. That's their job. They need to save people who are infected. We need to find out why they're infected and prevent it. Understand what the Rishon is saying and how we can rectify. We believe the environment is a technological problem, and we can fight it in technology. Put in more air filters, put in more rules and regulations, slow down industry more and more, until finally the communists will be able to take it over without an effort at all. And then the environment will cease to be so. If we consider it a human problem, then the answer is in education, not in technology. Is the function, appears to be the function of the powers that be in the East, to distract the West from their attention to the government. It's also been shown, I'm sure you've all seen reports, the extent to which a lot of the drug trafficking is motivated and funded from sources in the East. There they have a death sentence for. You try and introduce drugs anywhere there and see what happens. But we push you of the drug traffic into the West, and the understanding will be that break them down, break the moral fabric, break the family, break the young generation, ruin their will to fight, ruin their ethical essence, then it's a walkover. We're living in that society where not only is the East propagating that, but the West is accepting it. The West is beginning to think that way. And it's a system of thinking which is encouraged by Christianity, in a sense. Because Christianity does exactly that. It concentrates on the object, not on the subject. It concentrates on the object. It's outside the subject, the individual really has nothing much to do. He's able to relieve himself of all his sins and obligations by a couple of beliefs that he needs to. He doesn't have to work on himself to that same degree. He doesn't have to involve himself in a relationship with the object, which results in the service of Hashem. He doesn't have mitzvahs to that. That's not where the emphasis is. And so in such a society, it's very easy to distract people more and more away from the subject onto the object. Concentrate on science, concentrate on technology, concentrate on medicine, try and figure it all out. Torah too, it's so easy to become totally obsessed with the object at the expense of the subject. The objects of the mitzvah, of course, they're important. They're vital. Our tefillin, our Sefer Torah, our Torah, capital T, our Gemara, all objects. Our sukkahs, our lulavim, our glass of wine on Shabbos for Kiddush, these are all objects. Of course, they're important. But they're important only in their relationship to the subject. The Sefer Torah acquires Kiddusha because of what the Sefer put into it. A glass of wine at the Shabbos table acquires Kiddusha because of what the Mekadesh, what the man who's making Kiddush puts into it. That's what gives it its Kiddusha. The source of sanctity of the world comes from the governor, comes from the individual. And the more we build the individual, and the more we sanctify him, and the more we strengthen him, the greater will be the sanctity in the objective world around. We mustn't allow ourselves to be deviated and distracted into an obsession with the object and believing that the Kedusha is all to be found in the object. So that if all the objects are there and appear to be doing the right thing at the right time, everything is just fine. We need to work on ourselves. We need to build ourselves. We need to construct and develop ourselves, always increasing the Kedusha within us, within our relationship to the Chetzer outside us, in our relationship to the objects outside us. We will be able to exude Kedusha and to elevate them.